Movie Squad is sponsored by Luna Palace Cinemas, WA's premier independent cinemas, bringing the best film content and cinematic events to Perth. Come and enjoy the Luna Palace experience.
Toast.
Toast.
Right here. Right now. The most important thing in life will always be the
Movie Squad.
Salute me, familia.
Welcome to the Movie Squad podcast. My name is Tristan Fidler.
And my name is Simon Murata.
This is the podcast version of your weekly edition of Movie Chat, as heard on the radio every Friday morning, 7:30 a.m. on Breakfast with host Pam Boland, broadcasting from RTR FM 92.1, The Sound Alternative. And on this podcast, we basically indulge in movie chat. We talk about cinema releases, streaming releases. We talk about Australian films. We talk about American films. We talk about it all. And in this episode, we also have a bonus review to discuss, a new horror film that's out in cinemas already, which is a prequel to a known 70s franchise horror classic, and that is The First Omen, which relates to The Omen from director Richard Donner, starring Gregory Peck. But I'm really keen to talk about that one, because that was a film that I was not expecting to be what it was. So, and I'm glad that you've seen it as well, Simon.
Yes, we'll get stuck right into that. And I can say now, I'm not a big fan of The Omen.
Yes.
So I went in guarded, let's say that.
Yeah.
But we do cover that at the end of this podcast. We're going to replay now our performance on Breakfast with Pam. In the second part of our chat from Friday morning, we take a look at the Aussie horror film set in America, Late Night with the Devil, a really fun and interesting spin on the late night TV circuit in the United States. But first, Tristan, the movie of the week, what are we taking a look at?
Well, it's a new film from A24 Studios. From what I gather, one of the more expensive productions of recent years, and a new film from director, writer Alex Garland, responsible for things like Ex Machina, Annihilation, and the film Men. And that is Civil War, the film Civil War, starring Kirsten Dunst and Kaylee Spaney, and set in America during some near future contemporary version where there is a civil war happening between the Western forces and the main government in power. And we're going to hear a little bit from the trailer right now.
19 states have seceded.
The United States Army ramps up activity.
The White House issued warnings to the Western forces as well as the Florida Alliance.
The three-term president assures the uprising will be dealt with swiftly.
Let me know if you want to try anything.
Are you guys aware there's like a pretty huge civil war going on all across America?
We just try to stay out. With what we see on the news, seems like it's for the best.
Citizens of America,
the so-called Western forces of Texas and California
have suffered a very great defeat at the hands of the United States military.
Every Friday here on Brekkie, we take some time for the cinematic arts. We look into the brains of the blockbuster babes. They're here. I was about to think of something to rhyme with "they're here," but it's not appropriate or correct. How are you going, Tristan and Simon?
We're doing good.
That's
how are
weird,
you?
That's a weird intro.
No, that's
my
fine.
Worst one. I did
Perfect.
So well with the babe heaven, you know. They're not in my arms, but they're in the studio. And I cooked it on the intro. But how are you? Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. No, it's look, that I think it's great. I think, you know, we look to radio like we look to movies for so many things. And sometimes it's like polished dialogue and perfect delivery. And sometimes it's the chaos of life. And that's what we love, you know.
The chaos of life. Chaos on the radio.
This radio is Mumblecore.
Mumblecore? Do you want Mumblecore radio? Idea? Is that the kind of
no,
idea?
Probably not. But look, it's great to be here, as always. We're going to try to redirect into our usual cadence.
Yeah.
We have so many interesting movies to talk about this week, Pam.
There's a lot going on in the movie space, right? I don't know if you want to just dive right into it, but there's a lot going on. I've seen lots of movies recently.
What did you see recently? Let's
talk about that quickly. Okay. I talked about Love Lies Bleeding, Father of the Bride. I recently started rewatching, not a movie, The Heartbreak High, the new season.
That's been
great.
Which started off as a movie, The Heartbreak Kid.
I've seen that movie and I love it. It's great. It's got Claudia Carver. Is Claudia Carver the teacher?
Yeah. Oh, Alex Dimitriadis.
That's That's right. That's
I had
where
such
it all
a
started.
Crush on both of them. It was like I panic watching that movie. It's very, very gorgeous. I've been rewatching lots of old movies this week. I also rewatched two. I watched Kiki's Delivery Service for the first time. I'd never seen that.
I watched Kiki's Delivery Service for the first time this week.
This week.
Whoa. We worked together and we didn't even bring that up.
We didn't even talk about it.
My son has become really obsessed with Studio Ghibli, and these are the movies he can watch. So we watched Kiki's Delivery Service and Whisper of the Heart.
Whoa.
And he is engrossed by them.
Wow.
What did you think of Kiki's?
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, great film.
So magic, so charming. You're just sort of transfixed by the way everything moves around. Oh, so beautiful.
Did not know I was about a witch before
we
started.
Did not. But, you know, she has the little, she goes to her little bakery and I'm just like, Kitty, this is great. Yeah. But
Kristen, did you watch it for the first time this week?
No, I still have not seen it. So that's one on my to-do list.
If you can get it in before Sunday, then technically we will have all done it.
Yeah, we can do a triple jinx next week.
I'm looking forward to it. But, you know, that sounds like a great week of watching.
It's a great week of watching. Mm. I reckon there's a great weekend of watching in store. And it might include some of the movies we're talking about this morning. Tristan's kicking us off. Talk to me about Civil War.
Yes, Civil War. It's a new film from A24 Studios, and it comes from writer-director Alex Garland, who started off as an author. He wrote The Beach and then moved into screenwriting and then eventually directing, and is responsible for films like Ex Machina, Annihilation, The Very Divisive Men, which I quite liked, and also the series Devs as well, but has been involved in scripting a lot of things like 28 Days Later, the Dread movie.
Sunshine.
And I assume we've talked about Alex Garland before in the years that we've been doing Movie Squad, Simon, but I assume that you're a fan.
I'm a big fan. I mean, I've never read The Beach, his novel, but loved the work he did with Danny Boyle. Sunshine is my favourite Danny Boyle film.
Yeah.
And the movies I'm a big fan of as well, because they just explore areas you just don't anticipate. And I was really loved the TV show Devs. I thought that was such an interesting, and the tone and mood of Devs and Annihilation and also Men, which I enjoyed as well. And I think we might be in the minority. They are so foreboding and atmospheric. And I love that as an author, he's now become known more for tone rather than, say, dialogue.
And if you're a fan of Devs, you'll be good to know that he brings a good deal of the cast from Devs into this new movie, Civil War. And it seems to have a kind of a list of players that he's bringing from project to project. But Pam, I mean, Alex Garland, any of these titles strike you or that you've seen? Or...
No, falling flat for me, babe.
That's all right. Well, you know, that's the thing. He can be quite divisive as well, particularly Civil War. When the trailer for this came out, it was interesting to see some of the reactions to this, because it is a provocative movie. It is about America in the midst of a contemporary civil war, and it's a provocative move to release this during an election year in America and to play on kind of anxieties and fears and things that have been, you know, there in that country from, you know, I guess the past, you know, decade or so. So it's been interesting to see some of the reactions to the trailer and then to this film. Where will people fall on the line? And it doesn't matter if you are in America in terms of your heated response to this. But anyway, it is... what about Kirsten Dunst?
I love her. And
yes.
I actually, you've said Kirsten Dunst and Kaylee Spaney, and I really like both of them, and they're both in this. And Jesse Plemons, who I actually have only watched in Friday Night Lights.
Oh, that's where it all started for him.
Mandarin. Yeah.
But I haven't watched Killers of the Flower Moon yet, and I think he might be in that. But
yes.
I'm a big Kirsten Dunst fan. It comes with the territory of being a Sofia Coppola fan.
Of course.
So I think that's the sort of case there. And Kaylee Spaney in the new Priscilla movie from Sofia, which I also have yet to see, but I'm hanging out for. I love Kirsten.
She's the lead of this, and Kaylee Spaney is in the film. And one of the kind of promo videos that's going around is or them being interviewed and just talking about kind of almost like passing the torch in terms of being the protagonist of a Sofia Coppola film. And that Kirsten Dunst is kind of working with Kaylee Spaney on this film and saying to Sofia Coppola, oh, no, she's great. was, you know, one influence in getting her the role, aside from the fact that Kaylee Spaney is, like, a great actor. So, yeah, Kirsten Dunst is the lead in this film, and she plays a war photojournalist called Lee Smith. And the film opens up with her in a hotel room watching the current president of the United States, played by Nick Offerman, also from Devs, you know,
Nick
talk...
Nick Offerman as the... Wow,
yeah,
okay.
But he's a great dramatic actor for people who've seen Devs and what's it called? The Last of Us, which he just won an Emmy for.
He's just so silly. I just think of him as being so silly.
He's
so
very giggly.
Yeah, yes. He's very giggly, and imagining him as a as some sort of leader in that capacity is a bit bizarre.
You know, there are these two masks, right? There's a drama mask and a comedy mask.
Oh, my God.
And you kind of do that thing where you put your hand in front of your face and you go from smiling to frowning. And that's what Nick Offerman does.
Are you trying to take the torch from the comedy? You're like, I'm as funny as you.
And so, yeah, he is a good, you know, dramatic actor, but there might be a bit of a satirical, you know, thing with him being cast. But he, you know, he is basically delivering a speech on TV saying that, you know, the country's in crisis, but the forces, the Western forces, which is a combination of Texas in California, who are marching towards Washington D.C. to take him over, that they're in defeat, that they're you know, victory will be on their side. And as Kirsten Dunst is watching this on television in the distance in New York, another explosion goes off. So we're in the midst of kind of like a contemporary war between these states. And one area that the film has gotten a little bit of flack for is that Alex Garland with this film is not really kind of, you know, he's, you know, infers and alludes to certain things, but it's not about kind of blue state versus red state or Republican versus Democratic. He keeps it a little bit abstract in terms of why this civil war is happening. What are the reasons for this? And I think his main focus is on journalism and following basically four journalists who get into a truck together to go towards Washington, D.C. and to basically they have the chance to interview the president well before he gets kind of captured or disposed in this conflict. And that includes Kaylee Spaney as a kind of a young, up-and-coming photojournalist who looks towards Kirsten Dunst's character as a mentor. We've also got Wagner Moura, who's best known for the show Narcos, who is a journalist named Joel. And then Stephen McKinley Henderson, also from Devs, but also from Dune 1, who is an older writer named Sammy and is kind of like the mentor of the kind of the quartet. And basically, Alex Garland has cited Apocalypse Now as a kind of influence. And so this is kind of like the equivalent of that in that it's a road movie. We go from state to state, from moment to moment in this kind of strange, surreal state of contemporary warfare. And I really like this. I thought it was great. I was locked in from the start. And yeah, he just has a talent, Alex Garland, for creating unsettling situations. You're not sure where things are going to go, and that's the kind of the sense of tension and fear in the air with what's going on. And it is a kind of very tense movie. There are also moments of dark comedy right up until the very end. But I mean, the last half hour is basically putting you into the middle of a war zone. So it is a quite loud and an overwhelming movie as well, but one filled with great performances, particularly Kirsten Dunst in the lead, who's always, I think, been, you know, underrated, but has such a big career from being a child actor.
Do you think she's underrated?
Well, I think sometimes her talent as an actor, I don't think is sometimes, I don't know.
Well, she hadn't been. I might be wrong with this, but I don't think she'd been Oscar nominated until The Power of the Dog, which was only, what, 2 or 3 years ago with Jesse Plemons.
Maybe I'm in a bubble. Maybe
we just watched Kiki's Delivery Service where she voices Kiki.
I didn't know she did that.
Yeah, as a child, she voices Kiki.
Get out.
You can hear it. You can really hear it.
I love this accidental symmetry.
But yeah, I think that's fair. Like, child actors, I guess, are known for being precocious.
Yes.
And maybe get the same credit that, like, a good dog actor gets, which is, like, how did they get the kid to be that way?
Yeah.
And I think I agree that she hasn't really gotten the acclaim. You know, only now are we looking back at Marie Antoinette with a modern lens and going, like, actually, there's some interesting stuff going on here, both in the performance as well. So I do agree that she's underrated, but I do find it hard to point to a specific movie where you can go, that's the showcase for Kirsten Dunst.
Definitely. Like, in this role, she doesn't say much, but it's more on her face and kind of reacting to just the kind of well, her history as a war photojournalist, and then just the chaos going on. But I think it's in the same space as the lead performance that she did for Lars von Trier with Melancholia. Which is such a great performance, but one that I don't think got its flowers with everything that happened in the PR campaign in Cannes. But anyway, Civil War, I really thought this was great. It is divisive. I think some people will not take to the fact that he's kept it kind of abstract and not connected to maybe specific politics. But I think he's looking for something a bit more. And it's interesting, I think, in this time and where we are now with the idea of journalism. And it's not like a virtuous kind of like picture of journalism. We see them kind of get kind of almost like the adrenaline rush of being close to conflict without having to be part of it. But I think it's really great. Now, I know you haven't seen it, Simon, but I mean, have you heard much of this kind of like divisive reactions that either the trailer or the film had?
I definitely have. And let me now tap into my European roots and pull out a cigarette and say, like, these American critics, like, they need everything to be so didactic. And they need to be told, like, here is the exact moral imperative of the movie and here is the exact meaning behind it. And I think I'm much more excited by Alex Garland, who's British, of British heritage. I'm much more excited by using, you know, America's madness, right, as a backdrop for a more personal story and a story about journalists. I find that fascinating, and I think, you know, who knows, I might watch it over the weekend and come back and say, actually, no, it was... but ultimately, I'm more excited by the kind of movie Alex Garland could make versus an American director who has to draw very clean lines and really extrapolate what would cause a civil war. We don't need that. We know what would cause a civil war. It's happening, effectively. So I'm much more interested in the film that I have been trying to keep away from to a degree. Yeah. I'm aware of what you've said thus far, but I'm excited by the surprises that Civil War might hold. Now, what about you, Pam?
Yeah, Pam. I mean, you're a Kirsten Dunst fan, but her in the middle of a kind of a war zone, this kind of anti-war kind of movie, does that...
Yeah, I really want... I actually had sort of passed by this movie. I'd seen the cast and been interested in that, but I didn't really know what it was about. And I watched the trailer for it this morning and I was like, oh, yeah, I think I could go see it. But actually, upon hearing what it is about and what you think of it, I want to see it more now. Mm. I think you're saying it copped a bit of flack, but, you know, for not sort of asserting itself more strongly as whether it was talking about Republicans or Democrats. Mm. I am curious to know if it references, like, the Capitol riots in America from a few years ago or anything of that kind of nature. But I guess I answer my own question by saying, you know, if they don't reference the Democrats and the Republicans and the sort of specific nature of what's going on there, maybe they don't reference anything like that?
Well, I think they allude to certain things in terms of, like, the history of what brought them to this moment or the situations where you kind of feel, okay, these characters are channeling this kind of sense of prejudice or these conservative views. But I think it's a good way of kind of keeping the film a little bit like not tied to a specific time and place and almost kind of making it a little bit mythic in a way so that you could watch this movie in 3 years' time and think, okay, I'm into it because it's just taking me through this kind of road movie version of a conflict. And basically taking all these tropes that American movies have done for decades of when they do films about, you know, international war zones and have kind of like, you know, white, blonde-haired, you know, photojournalists in the middle and it becomes about their story or their crisis and everything else is in the background. But, you know, taking all those tropes and putting it into the American context I think is very interesting. So Civil War is out in cinemas now. And you can be the judge.
All right. We've had a couple of people get in touch while we were talking. Ashley has already seen Civil War and was surprised about how much it focused on the journalists and how the story affects them and affects the journalists, which I also is a prompt for me to go and see it. I've also had someone get in touch with a little bit of Studio Ghibli love, Craig getting in touch to say, I've watched Ponyo more than any other movie because of my kids.
Yeah, great.
So I think relating to you there, Simon.
Back in 5, 4. Now, here's Mr. Midnight, Jack Delroy.
Oh, good evening, Night Owls, and thank you for allowing me into your living rooms once again.
Well, Night Owls, we've got a heck of a show in store for you tonight, and I'm very excited for you to see it all unfold before your very eyes. I really hope you love it. Gosh, I hope you love it. Please.
flooding.
I'm trying to host Nashville syndicated talk show.
And I'm trying to help you keep it on the air.
We all know how important it is to keep our sponsors and affiliates happy, but in my humble opinion, there is only one person who really matters in this whole darn crazy business. And that is you.
It's 7:50 here on your Sound Alternative. You're tuned into Breakfast and we're talking all things movies. We're with the movie squad. The Blockbuster Babes are in. Tristan and Simon are here with me. We've talked about Civil War and we're moving on to Late Night with the Devil. Simon, scary.
Interesting film title. It is an Australian film, but you wouldn't necessarily know that by watching it because it does take place on the set of an American talk show. But what is fun about this film is that it is directed by the Cairns brothers, Colin and Cameron Cairns, who made a movie about a decade ago called 100 Bloody Acres. Tristan, did you see that?
I did see it, yeah.
Yeah, a really fun dark comedy. And Late Night with the Devil is similarly, you know, that film was very gory but funny. And this film's very funny as well, but not necessarily laugh-out-loud funny. So it's a very amusing scenario that builds to a sort of horrific crescendo. But Pam, the premise of Late Night with the Devil is that in the 1970s, there was a rival to Johnny Carson, the king of late night TV. His name was Jack Delroy, and he's played here by David Dasmalchian, who will be very familiar to people as soon as they see him. He's one of our preeminent that guys. He has a very distinctive face. But the way you would describe him if you were, you know, plugging him into an ensemble is he's sort of wormy. Worm-like. And I think that's, you know...
I'd love to make a worm reference.
Well, you know, and I say that with love, but I think if you've seen him in the Denis Villeneuve films, like Dune and Prisoners, even Dark Knight, the Christopher Nolan film, where he's in that briefly, like he's sort of a skeevy character. But what I love about what he does here in Late Night with the Devil as a talk show host now is that he's more slithery. And he's still... But he's still very charming and likeable. And I think he does a really good job here of conveying why this... historically odd film presence would be the anchor of a late night talk show. But effectively, when the film cuts in, we learn that he has been a rival to Johnny Carson for a number of years. He's not been able to overtake him. His wife tragically passed away and he's taken some time away from the screen, but has returned in more intent than ever to take the late night crown. And what the film is, what Late Night with the Devil as a structure is purported to be the last known footage of his final broadcast and what happened during the Halloween special where he sought to reclaim the ratings title or claim the ratings title. And during the course of this broadcast, and which unfolds like a regular late night TV show program, we're going to see him feature a skeptic who is willing to offer $10,000 to anyone who can prove some kind of communion with the spiritual realm. There's a psychic who does readings of the audience, trying to connect them to any ghosts that might be present.
Oh, no.
And there's also the survivor of a death cult, a teenage girl who is believed to be possessed by a devil.
Oh.
And they're going to see if they can exorcise her live on TV.
Oh, so exciting.
And everything goes really well for everyone. Tristan, how did you feel going into and then experiencing Late Night with the Devil, knowing this was sort of the framing structure of it?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it with a few caveats, but like, you know, I went with a crowd and they enjoyed it. They like laughed at every time, you know, they would the talk show host will get deep into talking about what they're going to do with regards to communing with the devil and all this stuff. And then he would go, and we'd be right back for a commercial. Like, I mean, it's a running joke, but everyone laughed. And there were like moments where, you know, yeah, I think the crowd really enjoyed it and it is entertaining. I think I was anticipating with the idea of it being a lost episode that it was going to be more like a found footage, but it does break that structure. There are like behind the scenes documentary scenes, and so I was hoping that it would kind of stick to the format and kind of, I don't know why they did it, but you know, to you know, have all that kind of expositional things come up throughout. So there were a few things that sort of kept me back from really fully loving it, but I really was I was entertained, and David Dashmal in the lead role, it's great. He's really great. And I want to give a shout out to Faisal Bazzi, who plays the psychic Chris Du, because I went to high school in Sydney with Faisal Bazzi.
Did you?
Yeah. And
he's a great actor.
Yeah, he was studying to be an actor in year 12, and he's great. Every time I see him in a TV show or a movie, I'm just thinking back to, like, oh, man, he is killing it. So
he's great in The Merger.
Yes, yes. So I want to shout out to Faisal Bazzi. I liked it, even though there were some things that held me back from fully. And it's been interesting in the lead-up to its release. It got mired in a controversy because it used some AI-created imagery, which became quite a sticking point for a lot of people. Now, this is like a low-budget film. I can understand the reasons for why they would have done, you know, and they're just like small images. They're small, like, you know, things like this kind of stay-tuned kind of image. But that was interesting to hear about, you know, and that's, I think, going to be a bigger conversation as movies go on, and particularly for studio productions. Like, there was a Marvel show that just used AI-generated for the title credit sequence that... One with Nick Fury, I can't remember the name.
Secret Invasion.
No one watched it. But so it was interesting to hear about. But overall, I liked Late Night with the Devil, and you were a fan of it as well.
I loved it, and I totally get, yeah, it doesn't stick to its own rules, and maybe you could argue that it would be better as like an anthology installment of like the VHS series, but it's so fun to watch it, and I think the hook of, you know, we'll be right back after these breaks, is really compelling, and I love, it's sort of a different to a traditional feature film structure. It feels like a TV show that you want to keep watching, Pam. And that AI thing, I think it's a relevant conversation, but that was a fake controversy. Like, I'm sorry. You want to watch a film that's been made 100% morally and ethically? Like, it ain't happening, folks. Every film you've seen is corrupt in some way. But I think it's fine for that to be part of the conversation as we progress. But I really, really enjoyed this film because it was just fun to watch. It wasn't... Mm. I didn't find it particularly scary. Mm. I think it's an easy entry for someone who is maybe afraid of horror, Pam.
That's me. Yeah. That's me putting my hand up in the studio. I reckon I could go see this. I like the idea of those interruptions and the sort of, oh, pause and we're going for commercial. Do you see the commercials or do you just come back like immediately?
No, that you get the interstitials instead.
Okay, yeah.
The commercials would have been fun.
See, that's if that was like I was anticipating that, but they spend more time with the characters, which you know you need narratively. But I would have loved to have seen some of the fake commercials that they could have come up with, particularly for you know this and you know. It's set in America, but it's interesting to hear about the filmmakers. They kind of reference Don Lane a lot, which I don't know for young Australians if that name means anything, but I remember growing up that he was a kind of like a talk show legend within Australia.
He was an American. He was an American who lived here.
Oh.
And he also had a famous stoush with like a debunker because he used to have psychics on the show.
Whoa.
And that was, I think, the seed of inspiration for this. So, and yeah, I grew up with that, you know, and Steve Izard. Like there's a sort of chintzy quality to the talk show. It's like, this guy really wouldn't be in competition with Johnny Carson. But I think from an Australian perspective, you know, it might be harder if you grew up in the US with all this talk show culture. But for myself, I just really enjoyed it as a framing device. I thought it was really fun and funny, a nice TV satire as well, which I'm always a fan of, and just a really compelling and well-made Aussie film.
Oh, love to hear it. I reckon I would go see this, maybe. Maybe I'd have to go and hold someone's hand. I don't love the idea about the young girl who's possessed.
Ingrid Torelli, I think she's really good in this as well. I think the whole cast is actually really good. So Late Night with the Devil, there's a special screening at Luna tonight, actually, being hosted by RTR FM presenter James Palm as well. So I think that'll be really fun. But Late Night with the Devil, go see it. I think it's well worth your time.
Ooh, exciting. All right, well, that's it for the breakfast version of Movie Squad, but there's always a little bit of extra goodness. Are you going to give a little sneak peek about what you're talking about? You set the tone last week by telling people what you were going to talk about, but they have to go listen, right?
Well, we get to talk about a film that's out and released now, and that might be too scary to talk about here with you, Pam, The First Omen. We're going to talk about The First Omen. Yeah.
Okay, I'm excited. Go check it out wherever you get your podcast. Tristan and Simon, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So there we have it, a fun discussion of Late Night with the Devil. Yeah, a film I enjoyed, but sometimes I guess it's always about trying to, you know, I think as film reviewers and film viewers, sometimes there's the idea of what we want to see and then what we get. And sometimes it's a bit unfair to kind of hold a film to some kind of, concept. that I had previous to the film. But, you know, I think it would have been great if it was a more, you know, a lost episode type of movie. And then I think with the style of Jack Delroy, and in the opening they set him up as a kind of rival to Johnny Carson, where it felt to me he was more of a kind of Dick Cavett type. So less of a flashy talk show host and more of the kind of...
Long-form conversation, yes. Yeah.
And it's funny, when you watch those old episodes, particularly Dick Cavett interviews pop up on my YouTube feed, and yeah, back then they're just like smoking freely on television. There's not the rush like there is now on contemporary late-night talk shows to fill every moment with a question or answer or with a game. You just get those kind of awkward, rambling conversations and sometimes the cough of the audience in the air.
Contentious. And that was the difference, right? Like Johnny Carson, you know, again, this is not a culture we grew up in, but like the idea of Johnny Carson is almost the birth of that really polished PR machine. Like I could be wrong because I didn't grow up with him, but I can't think of a contentious Johnny Carson interview, you know, where he let loose at a guest. David Letterman has those examples, but he's a different kind of, you know, sort of postmodern talk show host. So, yeah, I do think it was more of that Dick Cavett mold. And it was also that Don Lane mold. And I think that's what I kind of appreciated. Like, I know that some American critics have faulted it for its adherence to, or failure to adhere to, the American late night talk show structure.
Yeah.
But it felt very Australian to me. And that was, I think, part of the pleasure that I got from it.
But, yeah, it's a... I mean, yeah. Anyway, so Late Night with the Devil is out in cinemas now, but also out in cinemas, and one that we've teased in the intro, is a new horror film called The First Omen, which I didn't think, like, it came across when there was, like, a press release about it from Fox Studios that, yeah, there's a prequel to The Omen, it's coming out this year, and that didn't really fill me with any kind of sense of, like, expectation or interest. We've already talked at the start, you're not a fan of the original Omen.
Well, I think it's fine. Like, I would call it, like, a 3-star movie, right, which is... It is not a stone-cold classic like The Exorcist, like some of those other, you know, let's call them brand names, right, of horror, like those 70s classics. The Omen, I thought, was fine. you know, I didn't find it particularly scary. I think it has one classic, brilliant moment.
Yeah.
You know, the It's All For You, Damien, you know, with the nanny at the start of the film. But it was just never one that lingered in my head. And Damien as a character is cool as an concept. I've never seen Sam Neill's take from The Omen 3. But it was just, it's definitely not a franchise or a horror franchise that has loomed large in my life. What about for you?
Yeah, I mean, I've only seen the first one there. I mean, there are two more movies in this kind of, and then there's like a TV movie, the number 4, The Awakening. And then there was a remake in the 2000s, which was pretty forgettable from what I've gathered. But I've only seen the first one. And that came out the year after The Exorcist, but it doesn't have that same feeling of the William Friedkin film where, you know, it is kind of pushing things forward. It feels of that time of the classic new wave of American cinema, where The Omen has that, you know, it feels like it's two steps away from being a TV movie.
Yeah, it's a bit stodgy.
Not to disparage Richard Donner, who's a great director, and there are great moments, some of which I think about, is that the legacy of The Omen is often these, like, death scenes, which are kind of these weird accidents that happen to people, which almost is like a kind of, you know, a direct line to the future Final Destination franchise, which all those kind of movies sort of, and even this one, reference or replicate in a way. But this film, The First Omen was interesting because I also saw this weeks after seeing Immaculate, which was a film starring Sydney Sweeney that she produced, which I quite liked. It goes for broke, particularly in the third act, and it's, I liked it. But I also saw The Nun 2 last year, which is probably one of the most boring films that I sat through in a cinema. But, you know, this is the third film out of those three that are about American nuns going to Italy, staying in a convent / school, and then finding out that something untoward or sinister or mysterious is going on. So it feels like, you know, when I saw the trailer, I was like, this is treading, I don't know what I'm going to get from another horror film with nuns. But then I'd heard good reviews for this, and I thought, well, yeah, I'm going to see it. And it's always good to see a horror film in a cinema to have that sound design, that sensory surround experience. But yeah, it's the first film directed by Akasha Stevenson, who I only knew directed an episode of the show
Legion Brand New Cherry Flavor.
That's the one.
Flavor.
Yeah, Brand New Cherry Flavor. So I was very curious about this, and I also had not seen the M. Night Shyamalan show Servant, which is where the lead actor Nell Tiger Free comes from as well. But yeah, it's a similar plot to what I just described, where Neil Tiger Free plays a nun who comes to Italy, Rome in the 70s. She's met by a priest who's been in her life since she was a kid, like staying in different convents, played by Bill Nye. And then, yeah, she stays in this convent. She's kind of a little bit awkward, but well-meaning and hopes to make a difference, particularly to a child who is kind of being very much... kind of bullied and locked in rooms by the nuns and is considered evil for some reason. And then you also have Ralph Ineson, best known from films like The Witch and for doing lots of voice acting in the UK, who shows up as a priest with a mission that there, and it all ties to the first Omen, the original film, The Omen, that there is a child connected to the idea of bringing about the Antichrist and all of that kind of the number of the beast 666. You'll know them because they'll have the marks of 666 on their flesh. Now, I was very surprised by this film, but it's also great because you saw this film as well, Simon. You actually saw it last night. What impressed you about The First Omen?
Well, I love talking to you, Tristan. I love talking to Pam. I love being here with you. I wish I was rewatching The First Omen right now, even though I did see it yesterday. Yeah, yeah, similarly, it was not on my radar. In the same way that Exorcist Believer was on my radar,
yes.
You know, and that's a terrible movie, but I knew it was coming, and I was intrigued by it. This kind of surprised me, and I started similar to you, just hearing good word about it.
Yeah,
and I was sort of taken aback by how stylistically interesting it was, how actually adventurous it was in its style. The theme of it and the application of it, you know, it's been described by Akasha Stevenson as a female body horror, a film about rape. Mm. And I think thematically that is all extremely, I don't want to say this in a cavalier way, but it's ripe for horror, you know, true, like disgusting horror. And I like that they were approaching it in that thoughtful way. Again, it's the adventurousness of the style of it. And there were so many moments in the film. And I don't think it's style for aesthetic sake.
Sure.
There are so many... It's not just about, like, this composition is cool or that shot is cool. There are specific moments that were shocking to me.
Yeah.
There is a moment where a character breaks the fourth wall and stares directly into the barrel of the camera. And I sank into my seat. It was like the eyes pushed me back. And there were other such moments like that I was kind of, you know, I'm a big boy. I don't cover my eyes in a horror movie, but I was sort of gasping throughout the film at what was being accomplished.
Mm.
There are some very silly death scenes, accidental death scenes that in a weaker film would make the audience laugh. But there's a moment in the, I won't give away anything, but there's one of those accidental deaths that you have inferred in the opening of the film. And the character, instead of collapsing on the floor or, you know, something silly happening to them, they look back almost at the camera and just smile with blood coming down their teeth. And I thought the way it was shot was so compelling to me. And I thought that was what really elevated this.
Definitely, I agree with you as well because, like, you know, and even to compare it to something like Late Night with the Devil, which is, like, you know, fun. But this has, yeah, when I was watching it, I was just thinking, you know, this... I remember was sitting through The Nun 2 and just thinking, this is, like, you know... This is just like a property, but, you know, a director could really invest this with something, and it's just not happening. But here you feel the director, this sense of craft and taste, and that there are moments like just transitions between scenes where the camera is floating above Rome and then doing like zoom-ins and then the choral music.
Yeah, that moment was really disturbing.
Really, really adds a lot to it. And then, yeah, those moments where... to compare it to Late Night with the Devil, where it's like, it's, you know, it has moments where characters jump, surprise people from behind, you know, that kind of jump scare. But there are moments that are kind of unnerving and unsettling, and that lean into the kind of, you know, the great lessons from Japanese horror from the 1990s, that it's, someone jumping out at you in the shadows, that's scary. What's even scarier is someone just, like, slowly coming towards you and you can't do anything about it. And these moments of, like, powerlessness, of you know, speaking to the theme of kind of you're in the middle of something and everyone's just watching you not doing anything. So there are moments that are kind of unnerving and scary, but then just moments where you just like can't believe they got away with it. And I know that there's been some discussion in Q&As that I've heard where, you know, the censors in America that they did, there were kind of some battles fought and there are probably some things that were cut and left on the editing room floor, but there are some things that remain and might be images of the year in terms of their impact. So
Then it's fantastic to have it from that female lens and perspective, and I think they've really imbued this movie with meaning.
Yeah.
And then I think, you know, you mentioned taste as well, and I think the points of reference for this film, you know, that we're talking Repulsion, Possession, which is a film that is very explicitly referenced, and Akasha Stevenson has talked about that, Suspiria. There are just, like, there's real taste in the points. Pulse, the Japanese film Pulse in particular. I was just delighting in seeing this collection of inspiration applied to this franchise.
Yeah.
I think Nell Tiger-Free is fantastic in this film. There's a moment even, to talk about transitions where you see these spiders overlaid and then it cuts to her and she looks like a tarantula.
Mm.
I was just so kind of wowed by this film. So, look, I don't want to overbake it. This is absolutely one of my favorite films of the year. I think it's better than some of the films that were going for Best Picture last year. But what I mean by that is I was just watching this meal of a movie and it's like, this is so beautifully made, so well performed. There's so much meat on the bone here.
Mm.
It's still giving me those sort of crass horror movie delights that I go for. But there's just so much going on in this film compared to a lot of surface level didactic, not to sound like Woody Allen, but didactic American movies. So The First Omen, I loved it and I already can't wait to see it again.
And it does overcome, you know, some of the, you know, it is connected to the original Omen, and so the weaker moments are those
kind of... It is absolutely,
where it has to, almost like strategically be connected to the film. And maybe if it was not an Omen movie, it would be more free to go to some dark places that it really implies in the climax. So, but, you know, hopefully if this has an impact, maybe there's another opportunity for the filmmaker and the star in this world, but it'd be even better if they went on to make something outside of this franchise. But I also think that in comparison to the Sydney Sweeney film Immaculate, which was kind of a low-budget film that she helped produce, I think, you know, having a bit of studio IP budget definitely gives this film a sense of scale and atmosphere that they just knew what to do with. So The First Omen, out in cinemas now. If you're a horror fan, definitely one worth checking out. And yeah, you don't want to be, you know, I agree with you as well. This is not a film that I was like trying to hype up or go like, this is the best film of all time, but it's definitely exceeded expectations for something that's called The First Omen. So out in cinemas now, well worth checking out, and it's great to talk about it as an extra bonus review on this episode.
Pam wouldn't have wanted to hear any of that.
No. We've spared Pam. I think it's for the best that we talked about it off air in this episode. So yeah, thank you so much, Simon. Thank you all for listening, and we look forward to the next episode of the Movie Squad podcast.